I hate ego and arrogance. I really do. I think they're personality defaults. They're a weakness of character. So for me, first and foremost, you know, we will not hire anyone that displays any sort of ego or arrogance at all. Secondly, what have they done to achieve the success that they've gained in their life to get to where they are today? How hard have they had to work?
What does it take to grow a recruitment company from a one-person startup into an international business with offices in London, New York, and Singapore?
I have two very clear principles. I don't believe in smoke and mirrors when it comes to career progression. I think it's very important that people understand what they need to do to achieve that next objective. And I think promotions should be based on merit, not tenure.
100%.
And that there shouldn't be any glass ceilings.
My guest today, Nicholas Barton, has done exactly that. And in this interview, he reveals the specific strategies that have allowed him to scale his firm, the Barton Partnership, into a global leader in executive search and management consulting.
From day one, there was a very clear vision around what the art of the possible was going to be. When anyone starts a company, there's two ways you can go. One is lifestyle. Are you going to build something with a view of just maintaining sort of, you know, 5, 10, 15 people, turns over X amount of revenue, you take out a dividend, but it's never really going to grow? Or do you grow a business with a view of a potential event down the line that gives you an opportunity to take a step back, realize the value of your business, but, you know, pass it on to other hands that can then take it to that next stage of growth?
The Barton Partnership has been recognized by Forbes magazine as one of the world's best management consulting firms for 3 consecutive years and listed in Recruiter magazine's Hot 100 list of the UK's most profitable companies based on GP per employee.
Look, as a business, we offer unlimited holiday to our employees. We're very proud of that. On Friday, we finish working at 3 o'clock. Yeah, the office policy is 3 days in the office, 2 days from home.
Okay.
We have company socials regularly. You know, we have a very supportive culture.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm particularly excited about this episode, which was recorded in person at TYX Studios in London. Nicholas's story is one of vision and resilience, from nearly sinking during economic downturns to making big bets on interim management and international expansion. Nicholas has consistently played the long game, investing in people, culture, and platform when his competitors were chasing quick wins.
I often say that if someone's chosen to work for me, to work for this company, I'm very honored by that, right? Mm. And so, you know, I feel that the responsibility is on us to provide the best environment for them to become the best versions of themselves.
Awesome.
But make no mistake, they've chosen to work in a performance-led or performance-focused industry. And that just doesn't happen unless you make it happen.
Right.
And in that case, you know, to be the best, you've got to work for it.
In this episode, you'll hear how Nicholas has scaled a specialist firm globally, why he believes customer service beats selling every time, and the leadership lessons that helped him retain key hires for over 15 years. Nicholas, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So the reason we reached out to you is that what we found you, I think, Recruiter magazine, Hot 100 list. You guys are like number 17 or something on the list of
right.
The most productive recruiting businesses in the UK. I know you've won awards for like Leader of the Year with APSCO. You've been in the business for 30 years.
Yeah.
You've built, scaled an international business. So really, really excited to learn as much as we can from you.
Thank you. Well, I'll see what I can do.
All right. Excellent. So take me back to the beginning. How did you get into recruiting in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, again, I've told this story a couple of times. I think like most people in recruitment, I fell into it.
Yeah.
You know, I stumbled into it. It wasn't something that was on my radar at all. My original trajectory was more down the healthcare route. I was looking at osteopathy.
Okay.
So I was undertaking a sort of a part-time degree in osteopathy, which was a weekend course. During the week, I was working in a warehouse packing boxes for a fashion company. And the fashion industry is a theme that runs through my family, sort of the rag trade, as it were, is the industry I grew up in. So I was working for a company initially in the warehouse, and then I got promoted into the head office at the same time, obviously studying this osteopathy degree course. Mm. And got to a stage actually where I was actually quite enjoying the work that I was doing in the head office. Wasn't really enjoying the studying aspect. I'm not very academic. I hadn't gone to university. I did a BTEC at college, but that was it. And so I actually decided to stop osteopathy and continue working in industry, work in the fashion industry, follow, I guess, at the time what my thoughts were around, you know, my parents and my family in that industry. And did that for a couple of years, worked for some great companies like Nick Alfari and French Connection in the production office, you know, really focused on getting the garments made, et cetera. And then, you know, again, had an epiphany moment and decided, actually, this is not for me and I didn't want to do this. And, you know, came across the recruitment industry through my girlfriend, who was, you know, she was a secretary at a recruitment company. She said, you should try recruitment. I said, okay, that's an interesting one. And so found a fashion recruitment company. So Draper's Record is the industry magazine for the fashion industry. At the back, they have the vacancy section.
Yeah.
This is obviously before the internet.
Yeah.
And so a company called Fusion was advertising for a recruitment consultant. Yeah, they were saying, look, you don't have to have recruitment experience, but if you understand the industry, we'll look at you as well. And I thought, perfect. Well, fine, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
Applied and got the job, which was great. And joined them because I had nothing to lose. They were based on Wardour Street above the arcade, and it was just great. And I, you know, I guess within 2 or 3 months of working in that role, I just fell in love with recruitment. I found my thing, and so, you know, was there for about.
Just let me stop you there for a second. What was it that clicked in that role?
Well, I guess I love the human interaction and engagement. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed getting to learn about organizations. You know, I was, whilst I wouldn't pride myself on being academic, I'm very commercially minded. And so when I was going to a new company on a client visit and learning about the organization, I really enjoyed understanding about the business and how they'd got to where they are.
Yeah.
And really like got into the detail of actually how they achieved their success. And obviously, you know, talked about the culture and the environment and talked about the role, et cetera. And so really wanted to get a deep understanding of the organizations that I was supporting and really, really enjoyed that. You know, my curiosity around that was always very strong.
Mm.
I enjoyed the human interaction, as I said. So, you know, working with candidates, trying to find them their next career opportunity, which, you know, it will impact their life. And I you know, it's a very satisfying feeling, finding someone a great job.
Yeah.
Or in fact, even the dream job. And so, you know, immediately I sort of resonated and identified with that and thought, yeah, this is, you know, the sales aspect was a natural born. You know, during school, my Saturday job was working in Asda car parks selling car security. I'd have to run up to someone getting out of their car, convince them while they were shopping to give me their car keys. And while they were shopping, we would etch their number plate onto their glass on their car, because at that time in that period of, I guess, what the 1990s, people were stealing cars, changing number plates, and then reselling the car. So if you had your number plate on the glass, they're not going to steal your car. But, you know, my sales skills were really honed in that role.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
I had to convince someone, a complete stranger, that's come up to them.
To give you their car keys.
And I'm in a lab coat and I've got a lovely folder and I'm showing them all the press clippings around how cars are getting stolen. And, you know, it's best to get your number plate onto your glass. And, you know, that's where I really defined and honed my sales skills. And so it brought that experience into play.
Yeah.
And then I found my thing. And then I realized within a couple of years of doing that I really loved recruitment, perhaps more than the fashion industry. The challenge with the fashion industry is it's very cyclical.
Okay.
You know, 4 seasons in a year, 1 bad season in the shops, and, you know, that company could have a bad year.
Right.
And so it became very clear very quickly that whilst I enjoyed and really bought into the topic, because obviously I'd grown up in that industry, the reality was it wasn't very high paying.
Yes.
You know, you could work in the fashion industry for 30, 40, 50 years and still only earn £45,000-£50,000, which, you know, isn't a small amount of money. But when you're working that long, isn't a large amount either.
Yeah.
And so then started thinking about, okay, so I want to stay in recruitment, but I don't just want to do an average recruitment job. I don't want to do something that's just, you know, conveyor belt level sort of IT recruitment. And that's nothing against IT or any other industry like that, but it's more... You know, what I enjoyed about recruitment wasn't just the interaction, but it's, you know, that buy-in on the topic, the, mm-hmm. you know, the affinity and the understanding and really the empathy of, you know, what that person's going to be doing. And so interviewed at a few firms and came across an advert in the Sunday Times, and it had 3 briefcases on it, and it said, London, New York, Singapore, where do you want to be? And, you know, at the time I thought, well, I could be in any one of those locations. I'm half Danish. I could get a green card. I thought New York could be quite interesting. So I applied. And it was a firm called Ashbury Marsden. And I met the founder for an interview called Paul Marsden. And he and I just instantly clicked. You know, I really bought into him. I really could see an opportunity to learn from someone that has been there, seen it and done it. And he had a banking recruitment company, but they were based in the same building as Bain & Company on the Strand.
Okay.
And he said, look, I like you. I was going to hire you for one of the banking areas, but actually... We're in the same building as this firm called Bain.
Yeah.
They're a strategy consulting firm. It looks really interesting. I think there's a niche for this. Why don't you come on and work with me on building out this division? And I thought, why not?
So recruiting management consultants?
So taking consultants out of consulting and putting them into industry, putting them into corporates. Okay. And this was sort of 98, 99. This was just before the dot-com bubble. And so no one was doing this in London at all. No one was doing this. And so when I started, the challenge I had was that, well, Aspen Marsden was just all banking focused. So we bought what we called a CNI database, about 80,000 contacts.
Okay.
We got a hold of someone from Bain that, you know, we qualified, that was looking to leave. And with their permission, we, you know, it was the old days of spray and pray. We literally sent his CV out to 80,000 contacts.
that's the biggest candidate marketing campaign I've ever heard of.
We literally just blasted his CV out. And, you know, the response was overwhelming. Right?
Okay.
You know.
Well, Bain & Company, they're one of the top
So there's three top strategy consulting houses. There's Bain, McKinsey and BCG, Boston Consulting Group.
Yeah.
The MBBs, and they're the tier one consulting firms.
Yeah.
And the, as I say, the response was just overwhelming. And that led to the birth of what became the strategy practice for Asprey Marsden.
Yeah.
I grew that over 7 years from a standing start to seven people, eight people. We were the most profitable team in Asprey Marsden. We were the top recruiter for strategy recruitment in the industry. You know, in that 7 year period, other firms started emerging, other divisions, et cetera, because obviously word had got out.
Yeah, absolutely. As it does.
But we were really at the forefront of that. And then in 2007, Paul sold the business through a management buyout.
Okay.
By that stage, I was a director in the firm and a shareholder in the firm, but I didn't want to roll in with the new MBO.
Okay.
So I left with Paul, took my stake out of the business, and that gave me the founding financial stability that I needed to start the Barton Partnership, which is what I did in 2007.
Wow. Fantastic.
And that's my story.
Yeah. Okay. So that's super interesting and almost like being at the very beginning of that particular niche. Now there's a lot of companies in that space.
Yeah.
That's so interesting that you were one of the originals. What I'm really excited to learn from you, Nicholas, is the scaling of your business and then going international and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost don't know where to start because it's such a journey.
Yeah.
But if you had to sort of pull out, what were the key milestones along that journey? What would those be?
Yeah. It's a great question. There are a few, obviously. I think the first of the key milestones were some of the early hires that I made, who are actually still with me today.
Wow, that's incredible.
And I think, you know, for me, those are individuals that have had a fundamental impact in helping me drive the business forward.
Yes.
And that gave me sort of, I guess, the stability and platform to start making more strategic decisions around the future growth of the company as well.
Nicholas, you and I were talking before we hit record here, and we've just hosted an in-person event for our clients, and we had a number of guest speakers. We also did a sort of round table where people are sharing, you know, their challenges, their experiences, and helping each other.
Yeah.
And one of the common themes that cut across every business, that we had people there from UK, Germany, France, the United States, Canada.
Yeah.
And one of those themes, if you're building a business, is if you get the right people, life is good.
Yeah.
If you get the wrong people, it's so hard to really scale this because it's like, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And so I guess my question is, it's quite unusual to that your first few hires end up being with you for the duration because sometimes you don't really know what you're doing at that point.
Yeah.
And so why do you think that is? How did you identify them as being the people who were going to help you drive the business? And number two, how have you been able to hold on to them so long?
Well, to be fair, at the time when I hired them, it wasn't with the view that they were going to be with me for 18 years.
Okay, sure.
Right? I think you know, the mindset there was really, are these individuals that are going to help move the dial for us going forward?
Yeah.
You know, do they align with my culture? You know, do they align with me as an individual? do they buy into the vision? And I think, you know, coming on to your next question, you know, how have we maintained that? It's because from day one, there was a very clear vision around what the art of the possible was going to be.
What did you call it? The art of the possible?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when I started a company, when anyone starts a company, there's two ways you can go. One is lifestyle. Yeah. So are you going to build something with a view of just maintaining sort of, you know, 5, 10, 15 people, yeah, turns over X amount of revenue, you take out a dividend, but it's never really going to grow.
Yeah.
And the business is still very predicated on you.
Yes.
Or do you grow a business with a view of a potential event down the line?
Yeah.
You know, that gives you an opportunity to take a step back, realize the value of your business, but, you know, pass it on to other hands that can then take it to that next stage of growth.
Yeah.
And having gone through that experience with Asprey Marsden, having seen Paul and what he achieved, that was very much my objective from day one.
Great.
And so as part of that, what was very clear was that I needed to have the vision to go with that. Like, yes, what do we want to do? Who do we want to be? How do we want to achieve that?
Yes.
And so the game plan from day one, I didn't have a business plan. I could have written it on a napkin for, in terms of, and I can still do that today.
Yeah.
Was we didn't want to be everything to everyone. You know, we were very specialist in niche around strategy, which was the key focal point at the time. It's now broadened out, but it's still within a circle that defines us as a specialist firm.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I was very clear from day one around what we wanted to achieve, who we were going to be, how we were going to, you know, define ourselves in the market. And you know, I was very good at, you know, attracting people that had worked and operated in my market as well, that bought into that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there are, you know, one of the key hires at the very beginning who's still with me today is Mark Fagan.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, you know, Mark is someone that I was very familiar with because, you know, when I was at Asprey Marsden, he was at EM Finance doing strategy recruitment. He then left to go to a very big competitor to me, a firm called Hawker Watkin. And you know, I was very much aware of him in the market. When I joined the Barton Partnership, I reached out to him, we got talking, and sure enough, you know, he came on board and he's still with me today. He, you know, he leads the EMEA practice for private equity.
Mm.
But that was 15, 16 years ago when he joined.
Amazing.
And so, you know, I think, but the vision from that day hasn't changed to what we want to achieve today.
So I think you've partly answered this because I was going to ask, when you're a brand new business, how do you attract top talent, people who are already successful, right? That,
yeah,
part of it is you have a clear vision, yeah, and you show them how they can be part of that.
Right.
Could you say more about, like, because that's quite a tall order. And I think that's why a lot of new businesses struggle to kind of get the traction is because, you know, it's hard to recruit to a one person business.
Well, I think you've got to show that path, and that,
yeah,
you know, I think there are a lot of organizations now that have become too hierarchical.
Okay.
In how they're structured, too matrix, and I think we've been very conscious at the Barton Partnership over the years to ensure that we don't fall into that trap. In the early days, I think what was very important was to make sure that I could define a clear path and trajectory. Mm-hmm. I have two very clear principles. I don't believe in smoke and mirrors when it comes to career progression. I think it's very important that people understand, you know, what they need to do to achieve that next objective.
Yes.
And I think promotions should be based on merit, not tenure.
100%.
And that there shouldn't be any glass ceilings, right?
Yeah.
And so I was very clear on that principle to start with. And then perhaps the most important principle, which I was very transparent about from day one, is, you know, the opportunity for people to have, you know, share options in the business.
Okay, great.
And so, you know, I was always sort of very vocal around this and have been, you know, even to this date, that I'd rather have 50% of a larger pie,
right,
than 100% of a smaller pie.
Yeah.
And so the people I were talking to typically would be in larger firms where there'd be a small fish in a big pond.
Yes.
The opportunity to be a big fish in a small pond.
Yes.
And be a shareholder in that business, I think it was very appealing. And so, you know, that for me is probably one of the key ingredients. And, you know, quite frankly, I've just launched another recruitment company in partnership with another individual, a company called Search Chain, which will be focused purely a specialist firm focused on the fintech industry.
Okay.
And we're going to apply the same principle there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a startup business. I've backed it. You know, my partner, George Fearstone, runs it. He's the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
But we were very aligned from day one on the fact that, you know, we are going to offer, you know, share options to the right individual,
yeah,
as part of our growth story.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack there. If you don't mind me asking, what percentage of the business is available in terms of share options. And here's what I keep hearing from clients who have switched to Recruiter Flow. They are executing faster, not working longer hours, but using a platform that just makes sense. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM built specifically for recruitment agencies and executive search firms. No confusing menus, no endless buttons you'll never use. When someone new joins your team, they're up and running in hours, not weeks. And here's the thing. When your recruiters spend less time fighting with software, they spend more time doing what actually matters, having conversations with clients and candidates. Several of our clients at Recruitment Coach have made the switch, and they're telling me it's transforming their operations. If you want to see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. That's recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. Versus how much you're retaining.
Well, I think now we've distributed about 35% of the options to the business.
Great. Is that like a EMI
share options? Yeah, so it's options. So, you know, the benefit to me as the employer, as the owner, as it were, is their options over shares.
Yeah.
Then there are no voting rights. They're not dividend bearing.
If they leave,
or we terminate their employment, they stay with the, they fall back into the pot.
Yeah.
But equally, you know, at the point of a transaction, they materialize into equity.
Yeah.
At a very favorable tax rate. I mean, it's a tax benefit. There's a tax discount for anyone with EMI.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, there's a benefit to them. Hmm. It's a great retention tool for me as an employer.
Definitely.
But there's no commitment beyond, you know, a contract between the two of us.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think that sort of gives an individual sort of the comfort and the reassurance that they're a part of the business.
Right.
And for
it's
me,
that it's almost a sense of ownership and, you know,
100%.
The mindset that goes with that.
Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of people with EMI now in the firm.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
You know, I am. And, you know, I believe to them it's meaningful, you know, not just the value of it, but just the fact that they have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would hope one day that they realize the value of that.
Yeah. And what do people need to do to qualify for the scheme?
Typically, I mean, it's based on a number of things. You know, obviously, you know, principally it's discretionary, right?
Okay.
It's based on my sort of view of that individual. You know, it goes beyond just, you know, their financial performance.
Yeah.
It's their contribution to their business, loyalty, support, going above and beyond.
Yeah.
You know, someone who walks in at 8:30 and leaves at 6 probably isn't going to qualify.
Okay.
You know, I as I said, I didn't go to university. I was studying osteopathy. I fell into recruitment, you know, and, you know, I've built myself to where I am today. And the reason why I do that and I've got to where I am today is because I'm first in and last out.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some very basic principles that I look for in individuals.
Yes.
You know, not everyone who's got EMI necessarily is the top biller in the firm, you know. It's about sort of their commitment, you know, their drive, their discipline to ensure that they do everything they can to be successful.
Okay, let's talk about that. If we have time, I'd love to know more about, we'll definitely get back to the milestones, because the first one was getting a few good, really strong people straight off the bat who are going to move the needle. But since you raised it, what is your view of what makes a successful recruiter that you would hire into one of your businesses? Here's what I keep hearing from clients who have switched to Recruiter Flow. They are executing faster, not working longer hours, but using a platform that just makes sense. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM built specifically for recruitment agencies and executive search firms. No confusing menus, no endless buttons you'll never use. When someone new joins your team, they're up and running in hours, not weeks. And here's the thing. When your recruiters spend less time fighting with software, they spend more time doing what actually matters, having conversations with clients and candidates. Several of our clients at Recruitment Coach have made the switch, and they're telling me it's transforming their operations. If you want to see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. That's recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow.
That's a good question.
And I think more importantly, how do you evaluate that? Because what we're talking about are don't show up on a CV, right?
Yeah.
There are things like,
yeah.
I'm guessing, drive,
yeah.
you know, relentlessness,
yeah.
You know, grit or resilience,
yeah.
you know, empathy. What there are qualities which are difficult to assess, and everyone tells you they have them, but you know, how do you?
Yeah,
yeah.
I think the key to this is not necessarily to think about hiring someone who's similar to yourself, right?
Okay.
But there are personality traits, behavioral traits that you would look for.
Mm-hmm.
And the cultural fit is probably one of the most critical aspects.
Sure.
You know, from day one, we were very clear in defining the culture of the business that we wanted everyone to align to.
Yeah.
You know, I hate ego and arrogance. I really do. I think they're, you know, their personality defaults, they're a weakness of character. So for me, first and foremost, you know, we will not hire anyone that displays any sort of, you know, ego or arrogance at all. Secondly, you know, what have they done to achieve the success that they've gained in their life to get to where they are today? How hard have they had to work?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look for grafters. I look yeah. for people that are prepared to go above and beyond, that appreciate that there is a direct correlation between input and output, and that I'm a direct example of that. You know, the harder you work, the more money you make. And that's probably one of the most important things I think that the recruitment industry has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, you know, when you're looking, when we're assessing individuals for the Barton Partnership, beyond just, you know, their financial success, you know, we're looking at, you know, are they a fit culturally?
Mm-hmm.
You know, our values are human and aware and committed. They mean something.
Human, aware, committed. Committed.
You know, treating people how you would want to be treated.
Yeah.
Being aware of, you know, that individual and what drives them,
mm-hmm.
you know, what influences them, what impacts them, et cetera, that empathetic side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making sure that, you're supporting that person and committed to, you know, becoming a better version of yourself.
Mm.
And so for me, that's been a journey that I've been on for the last, 20 years now, if not 30 years. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, what is it they want to achieve?
Yeah.
And how can we support them to achieve that? And how hard are they prepared to work?
Mm-hmm.
We don't work 20-hour days, 7-day a week. You know, that balance is important, but there are times where balance is a luxury that one simply can't afford. And so people have to acknowledge that and realize that actually, if I need to get in at 7 to speak to someone, or I still need to send CVs out at 7:30 in the evening, I'm going to do that, not leave it till the next day.
Yeah.
And so it's that sort of mentality that we look for.
Nicholas, what you're saying is gone out of fashion. And
I know.
So, let's dig into that a little bit, because a lot of companies are moving away. So traditionally,
yeah.
recruiting is like, you know, 8 till 8, or, you know, it's long days,
yeah.
and it's definitely not a 9-to-5. And as you say, the mindset is like, the harder you work, the more money you make.
Yeah.
And that's certainly when I started in recruiting, that was definitely the overall school of thought. Anywhere you went, any recruitment agency, it was likely to be that style.
Yeah.
And I think maybe in order to make it easier to hire, because many, many, many people don't want that.
Yeah.
Then, and to try and, you know, attract more people to the business, that softened a lot. And you know, the idea of work-life balance is very popular. So what's your take on all that?
Yeah, listen, again, you know, I genuinely appreciate the value of balance without doubt, right? But I also know that, as I've said before, that there are times that it is just a luxury that one can't afford. Look, as a business, you know, we offer unlimited holiday to our employees.
Mm.
And we're very proud of that. You know, on Friday, we finish working at 3:00.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, the office policy is 3 days in the office, 2 days from home.
Okay, great.
You know, we have CSR days where we'll do things for charity.
Right.
We have company socials regularly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a very supportive culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a business, you know, we will go above and beyond. I often say that if someone's chosen to work for this company, I'm very honored by that, right?
Mm.
And so, you know, I feel that the responsibility is on us to provide the best environment for them to become the best versions of themselves.
Awesome.
But, you know, make no mistake, they've chosen to work in a performance-led or performance-focused industry.
Yeah.
Right? And that just doesn't happen unless you make it happen.
Right.
And in that case, you know, to be the best, you've got to work for it.
Yeah.
And as I said, look, I wouldn't be where I am today. And I'm a, you know, I am, you know, the example in that regard of someone that, listen, I grew up in a comfortable house, but, you know, we certainly, you know, it wasn't silver spoon. You know,
yeah,
there was
yeah.
no sort of family wealth, et cetera. My parents worked hard. And I think that's where that sort of mindset was very much instilled in me from day one around, you know, you have to work hard to achieve success. You know, I am where I am today simply for the principle that I work hard.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, you know, I you know, I'm not a materialistic guy by any stretch. I mean, I wear a Swatch watch, right? So,
cool.
But I've got myself into a position where I don't have to worry about money. But that's because I've worked to get in that position.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the interview process then. You're very clear on the sort of person you're looking for.
Yeah.
What are the ways in which you would determine whether or not they possess that culture fit and those same values?
Yeah. And I think, look, to be clear, it's not scientific.
Right.
And not every hire that we've made has been successful or aligned to our culture.
Yeah.
The reality is until that person's sitting in the chair and within that environment for a defined period of time, you're really not going to know. So I want to be clear, we've not got this right every single time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think first and foremost, it starts with that sort of gut feel test, you know, getting to know that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that first interview is very much a two-way street. You know, it's not a competency-based sort of case study assessment. It is a, tell me about yourself. Let me tell you about the Barton Partnership. Tell me about you. What drives you? Tell me about your family. What's important for you? Where do you want to be down the line? What would your friends talk? How would your friends describe you, et cetera? You know, what annoys you? What makes you happy? What did you not like in your last job? I mean, there are various questions that you can use to really assess how that person thinks and how that person engages with the world. And I think that that starts to build up a profile. And I guess it comes down to that gut feel, you know, and, you know, we call it the airport test. You know, is this someone that you could be stuck at an airport with if the flight was delayed or cancelled for a prolonged period of time?
Yes, that's a good one.
And I think, you know, for me, we sort of use that as the sort of the litmus test.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, as they progress through a process, you get more into the granular around their performance, how they, if they're a recruiter, how they engage their market, you know, what's been successful for them, where are their development areas, you know, what still needs to be worked on, how we can support them around that. We get them to meet as many people as possible. We'll go out, we'll take them out for a breakfast, lunch, dinner. We'll take them for a beer after work. We'll do, you know, as I'm sure most people do, you know, check their social media, et cetera. And then, you know, we'll make a decision, but it's a collective decision based on everyone's input.
And I think that's everyone's input. Who's included in that?
Depends. I mean, if it's a, you know, typically it would be a divisional hire, right? So, you know, everyone associated with that division, including the team itself, right? So, you know, we'll want everyone to, you know, have an input and a say if they've been involved in the process.
Yeah. I think that's quite good, actually, from a, so that's the way I was recruited into the company that I spent the longest with when I was a recruiter. And I think it's quite clever because your future colleagues, as it were, are the best people to sell the opportunity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they are going to give, you know, obviously the manager or the owner are, if they want to bring someone on board, you know, they're going to paint it in the best possible light, potentially.
Yeah.
Whereas with the colleagues, you can sort of ask questions like, what's it really like to work here?
Yeah.
What's a typical day?
Yeah.
But really, they're helping you to sell the opportunity to that individual.
But I think that's an important point to note. We don't sell.
Okay.
And I think that's a really important point for us.
So tell me more about that.
Well, I think, you know, it's very important for us that we present we don't sell. Right.
Okay.
You know, we've got a very simple sort of, well, I do, a very simple mantra. We are who we are and we do what we do. And that's either going to work for you or it isn't.
Okay.
And I say that to every person I meet with, because I think it's very important that we set the baseline of a discussion that, look, I'm not here to sell to you why you should join us.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you about who we are. I will tell you about what we do. I will tell you about what we can offer you and why, you know, this could be a good home for you. And then you need to make your decision based on that. Because I think where a lot of companies go wrong is that they do sell and invariably someone joins, and within a very short period of time, they see through it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, they were sold on the promise of this, or they were told that this company is this. And they realize as soon as they're on board that actually everything was a pack of lies.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that a lot. So that doesn't really benefit anyone.
No, definitely not.
It's sort of a false positive, really. So,
yeah.
You know, for me, it's sort of, look, be transparent.
Yeah.
You know, we're not the best company in the world. We try to be, right? We're very, very good at what we do in our market. We are the market leader in our space. We're very proud of that. And this is why. And this is the platform. And again, you know, the platform is perhaps one of the most important points around the business because, you know, from day one, that was a very important aspect for me in terms of, you know, again, a very simple principle. I don't believe in building a house without a solid foundation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get a lot of recruitment companies that were just invested in the front end and the sales, et cetera, and getting the people on board. And then think about their back end in terms of their support capability, whether it's finance, marketing, people, operations, et cetera. But from day one, we've sort of almost tried to, you know, keep that in touch with one another as we've built and progressed. And so we've now got, you know, a great platform for people to engage with. And we've created a great environment and ecosystem for people to really thrive. And I think, again, you know, testimony to that is the low turnover of staff that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I take your point about present, not sell. I think what you would what you've just described, I would still call selling, right? Because you're presenting, as you, in your words, you know, what you're all about, your ethos, you know, what's great to work here. It doesn't, you know, so to me, professional selling isn't misrepresenting, right? But I, you know,
but what we're not saying is we're not saying, listen, we're the best company in the world,
right?
With the best incentives, we've got the best logo, you know, we offer the best package, we offer the best this. It is. Look, we've got very good incentives, we've got a great platform, you know, we've got a great reputation in the market, you know, we treat staff really well and we care for people, we do. You know, it is very much a family feel. And you know, this is what's in it for you. But you know, you will get out what you put in.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Definitely. Let's talk about the platform. When you say that that's one of the cornerstones of your success, and from the beginning that's been something you've been very focused on. So what does that include?
Well, look, it's the people and the capabilities, right? Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about marketing. A great example. We operate in a very niche area, and there really isn't any, you know, there's no medium for our market. There's no publication, no TV channel for strategy. If you look at accounting, there's Accountancy Age.
Yeah.
If you look at marketing, there's Marketing Weekly.
Yeah.
There are various IT publications, etc.
Yeah.
You know, most industries will have something that represents that industry.
Yes.
There isn't anything for strategy other than The Economist, which is probably the closest thing. But even then, that doesn't
broad.
It's quite broad.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, from day one, we you know, to enable us to raise our brand in a niche market, you know, it was important that we built a marketing capability to support and raise our brand in that respective market. And also to ensure that actually when someone picked up the phone to speak to a client or a candidate, there was a level of awareness around who the Barton Partnership was. And so, you know, we invested, you know, very heavily in our marketing capability and how we engaged the market. We would have, you know, regular conferences, networking events, you know, great speakers would come along. Sebastian Coe, Ranulf Fiennes, Susie Wolf. During COVID, we did a virtual with Tim Peake. We had nearly 1,000 people join that.
Wow.
You know, webinars, podcasts. You know, we've interviewed some fantastic people over the years. White papers, insight reports, roundtable, breakfast network sessions, etc. All of these things the business has invested in to not only raise the profile of the business, but the individuals within the business.
Yes.
Right? To enable them to really engage their market in the most effective way. So that was really important. Finance and capability, I think, was, you know, that finance capability was, again, a critical part of that. The operational side, the CRM system, the platform, you know, the tools that the consultants can use, again, making sure that they were aligned and working as efficiently as possible to ensure that they had the right tools to engage the market with at the right time. people, learning, development, training, all of that aspect. Again, that was something that we've consistently invested in to make sure that we can really, you know, we've got the best people working in the most efficient ways. So, yes. You know, again, that's all things that, you know, I made the decision very early on to invest in, to a point at the expense of profit.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, it was always with the game plan that there is, you know, there's a tortoise and hare story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw that very early on when I was starting the business, because I've got a lot of friends that started recruitment companies that didn't really approach it from that perspective. And so while I was being the tortoise, they were being the hare.
Yeah.
And so they would accelerate past me, both in terms of size and revenue and profit and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And I was doing my thing. And slowly but surely, and ultimately, we've now overtaken all of those firms because, you know, now we've created that platform that we can bring people in on, plug them in. And sure enough, a lot of these firms that hadn't invested in their platform that got to a critical scale are now looking back and thinking, well, you know, now we've really got to invest money to build a platform to give us that next phase of growth.
Yes.
And so, you know, we did that very early on and we've benefited from that.
So, Nicholas, love that and 100% subscribe to that. What you've done, though, is very, very challenging. Like, I can see from a 100-person business, you're a multinational now.
Yeah.
You know, you have the resources, you can have the learning development team, the IT, the, you know, tech stack and the marketing and all that stuff. But how did you get there when you were still small? Let's say you're a billing manager, you're a small business.
Yeah.
You know, what were the kind of phases in which you brought those things in?
Well, it's very simple. It was one hire at a time.
Yeah.
You know, there was no initial investment for a private equity firm that enabled me to bring in 10 people you know, it was very simply, it's taken 18 years to get to where I am today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the short answer to that is one hire at a time. Every hire that we brought in, you know, would have an impact, a financial return. And we use that financial return to bring the next hire and the next hire and the next hire and the next hire.
Well, okay. Like, break that down a little bit. So do you have a formula for when to make that next hire?
No.
You said, like, we have the... No.
No,
okay.
No.
All right.
No. Again.
So it's not like need 3 months worth of, you know.
No, it was, you know, is that person making money? Are they profitable? Are they covering their costs and making a profit? Yes. Yeah. Fine. Get the next one in.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've read numerous books. I've listened to various people that have created their business on the back of a well-defined and articulated business plan that they followed to the letter. And I don't disagree with that model. Mm-hmm. That's not what I did.
Okay.
I didn't have a well-defined business
plan. But then how did you handle a situation where, let's say, you've got one person, they're up and running, they're covering their costs, they're profitable, okay, on to the next hire.
Yeah.
Now, it's going to take them a few months to catch up.
Yeah.
Now, but meanwhile, person A has a slump.
Yeah.
And so now your overheads have gone up.
Yeah.
Your revenue's gone down.
Yeah.
Cash flow.
Yeah.
What do you do in that situation?
Well, look, I mean, listen, let's be clear. There's been, you know, more than one occasion over the last 18 years where we've sailed very close to the wind. And, you know, listen, I mean, there's a reason why I don't have any hair left. You know, that's probably one of the key prices that I've had to pay. But we've got through it. I think what's been important for me was having the right people around me as advisors, mentors, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, having that support network of individuals that I could pick up the phone to and say, look, what do you think? Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I'm thinking. Do you agree? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we're sailing a bit close to the wind. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Should I cut now? Mm-hmm. Am I being premature? Should I wait? Hold the line and see if it turns.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of those conversations over the years at various times. I mean, look, I took a company over the last 18 years through, you know, what was Brexit 2007. Well, so financial crash 2007.
Yeah, that's a big one.
We've had Brexit, COVID, and the slowdown over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And you know, throughout that, we've continued to progress quarter on quarter, year on year to move forward. You know, we've never blanked a month.
Wow.
And we've continued to grow. And back to your, you know, original question around milestones, you know, I would say the first milestone for us was really some of the key hires we made at the beginning that gave us the financial security to continue building. Mm-hmm. The next key milestone is when we launched our interim practice.
Ah. And what was that?
That was about where are we now? So I would say that's probably about 8 or 9 years, even 10 years into the business.
Okay, wow. So how many heads were you at that point?
Oh, 30, 40 okay, people.
Yeah.
Still only UK focused. Mm-hmm. But you know, clearly the market was evolving and the interim space in our market was starting to build. And yeah. obviously we needed to be in that. We tried it ourselves for a while. And by that, I mean, you know, hire an interim recruiter or someone who knew how to recruit into the interim market.
Yeah.
But we weren't getting a lot of traction.
Mm.
A key turning point was when I brought on a chap called Nick Adlam. And I say brought on, went into sort of partnership with to a point. He was a former manager from Bain, head of strategy of an industrials company.
Mm-hmm.
He was on our books. He got introduced to me by one of my consultants. And we got talking. And, you know, what struck me about Nick was that he was very entrepreneurially minded, which is unusual for people coming out of consulting. But he was just, you know, he was a needle in a haystack in terms of an individual that understood the strategy market, was a strategy consultant, but was actually quite commercially minded,
mm-hmm.
engaging,
mm-hmm.
Salesy, but in a non-salesy way, if that makes sense. And he bought into the vision of what we were trying to achieve. He loved the idea of what we were looking to do in terms of that disruption to the market, and came on board. And so, you know, he took on a minority shareholding in the business, launched the interim business, and it just, you know, once he was on board, his credibility as an ex-consultant just, you know, was the key turning point for us as an organization in terms of, you know, engaging in serious discussions about how we could support businesses with interim consultants.
Amazing.
And that really just, you know, launched what became, you know, a definitive part of our business that accounts for, you know, 45-50% of our revenue now.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So first milestone, those key critical first hires.
Second
fast forward,
yeah,
interim. 10 years, you're yeah. about 30,
and then
40
New York
people,
was interim. Probably then the next one. So then, you know, the next... So from day one, if I take a step back, from day one, there were three principal pillars that we established. I say we, it's myself and a chap called Richard Saunders, who was my non-exec director from day one.
Okay.
You know, very good friend of mine, old candidate.
It's quite rare to have an NED from the beginning.
It is. And, you know, I would almost call him a part founder as well, in as much as, you know, we meet at Smith's in Farringdon a lot. Talk about the art, the possible in relation to the Barton partnership. Richard is an ex-consultant himself. He was at Burlington that got bought by Deloitte. He was working with Deloitte. Then he went to Bain. He was then head of strategy at John Lewis. And then he set up his own private equity investment vehicle. Mm. So, you know, I've got an individual that's worked in consulting, strategy in industry and private equity, which are the three key areas that we operate in. So
got
he
it.
Understood our market.
Yeah.
But more importantly, perhaps, is that he's got a very practical, logical mindset,
mm-hmm.
you know, and has been the weight to my balloon for the last 18 years. And quite frankly, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for his counsel. But we sort of established from day one that there were sort of three key pillars that we needed to achieve, or a tick, as it were,
mm-hmm.
to get us to a point where we've got something viable that we could take out to market. One was, you know, establish a niche specialist focused recruitment company. Well, that's, you know, strategy. Yeah. Two was that we needed to have an interim book, an interim business that accounted for at least 50% of our revenue.
Okay.
We did that.
Yeah.
And the final pillar that we needed to achieve was establish a flag internationally and create a profitable office outside of the UK.
Awesome.
And show that we could actually
take
this.
Why was that important?
Because that's what buyers look for.
Okay.
You know, they look for the ability to grow something beyond the borders of the country that they're in, right?
Okay.
So, you know, establishing a profitable international office was another key. And look, over the years, I met with loads of corporate finance people. You know, I enjoy and I'm very good at networking. So it was really important for me to, again, you know, I had a great learning experience with Paul at Asprey Marsden, but I also knew that there was still a gap in my knowledge around what we needed to do to achieve success.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd go to every type of recruitment event there was,
mm-hmm.
to understand actually, what do we need to be thinking about? How do we need to be positioning ourselves? How do we need to establish ourselves to get this business to a point that when we are ready to go to market, we've created the right platform, the most valuable proposition that someone's going to look at. And those were the three key pillars. Niche, you know, split between contract and perm, and at least one profitable international office.
Interesting.
And so that final sort of milestone was really, you know, well, actually, we achieved it in two areas. One was in Asia Pacific.
Yeah.
That came
in Singapore.
Yeah. So that came through an acquisition.
Okay.
We had created a partnership with a woman called Adrienne, who created a business called Shackleton. She was a former colleague of Richard's, but had moved into recruitment in Asia, doing strategy recruitment in Asia.
Oh.
So we had a sort of a, like a BA alliance sort of thing going on where, you know, she had her business, we had our business, they didn't cover Europe, we didn't cover Asia, and we would sort of cross share or whatever. Yeah. But actually, the conversations evolved and we got to a stage where I said, well, look, why don't you come on board? Let's make this a proper thing. And so we bought the business, rebranded it, and that established our Asia Pacific presence.
Excellent.
But in the US, we did that organically and the old-fashioned way. So to start with, do you want to talk about the US?
Yeah, definitely. So when was this?
So this was about 7 years ago, six, 7 years ago.
Okay,
and fantastic. So, you know, the US was always on our agenda. The US is, you know, the home country for consulting. That's where consulting was born.
Absolutely.
Right. So we needed to be
executive search grad of consulting.
Right. So we needed to be there. We needed to have a presence. What I'd seen over the years is a lot of companies that had gone to the US and failed. And the principal reason why they'd done that is because they hadn't done their homework. They were heavily invested. They had a lot of money. They thought, okay, look, let's just put a team on the ground and we'll go for it. And we'll replicate what we've done in the UK over there.
Yeah.
No, it always failed. Yeah. I didn't see anyone succeed. For me, it had to be done the hard way. And the hard way was for me to, and I did started this, you know, started to build out a network of clients and candidates in New York from the UK.
Yeah.
I would go over at least once a month, spend a week there, pound the pavement, press the flesh, starting to build our brand, starting to build our reputation, started doing deals from the UK, proved the concept.
Yeah.
You know, got to a stage where actually, do you know what? We've got enough clients now and enough of a candidate base to really show that we can make this work. We now need someone on the ground.
Yes.
And again, the next milestone was, you know, finding the person that was going to lead that. And we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Now, was that an American or a Brit?
It was a Brit.
Yeah.
But she'd been in America for a while.
Okay.
So had adjusted to the culture.
Yeah.
She was operating in our market, which, talk about a needle in a haystack. If Nick was a needle in a haystack, Vicky was she was a needle in a galactic haystack.
Barn. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because what we had a Brit that understood British recruitment style.
Yeah.
In New York,
yeah,
operating in our market.
That's kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, it's
the perfect
shot, one in a million. Okay. So we got talking. Long story short, she came on board.
Okay.
Very excited. Still remember her first day.
Yeah.
Found a WeWork just off Times Square. And that led to the birth of our first, you know, our New York office. And
fantastic.
We took that forward from there.
So the playbook, you've departed a little bit from what I would consider the playbook for British companies expanding to America, which is the first two is first build a book of business from the UK.
Yeah.
You know, and secondly, go over on a regular basis in person, make those, you know, trips over to meet people in person.
Yeah.
And then once you've got some traction, then... What I've seen work is you send someone from the mothership, the missionary goes over to, you know, bring the culture that you've got and the values and the processes and the systems over there.
Yeah.
Because the risk, and obviously it's worked out for you, the risk of hiring someone who's from outside your company is that the business in the States ends up being completely different to the business that you have in London.
Yes. Now, you're right and wrong on this.
Okay.
You're right in the fact that there was obviously a risk, an inherent risk when we brought her on board that she didn't know us as a company.
Yeah.
However, what we did very quickly was move someone from the UK over to support her in building out.
Yeah.
Right. And so presumably, did she
spend time over here
exactly,
as well?
Exactly. So to mitigate the risk, you're absolutely right. That was a key consideration. To mitigate that, she came over a lot. I went over a lot.
Yeah.
We then moved someone over to work with her that had been with the business for years, knew the company and the culture. And so, you know, we mitigated that by making sure that there was a lot of engagement and that she understood who we were quite quickly.
Yeah.
But I think that the benefit to finding someone who had adjusted to the US culture was that there was a better level.
Because it is different.
100%.
Yeah.
And if I talk about the business in a two-step forward, one-step back, I'll always talk about the US. because for a few years, that was exactly it. It was two steps forward, one step back, or in some cases, one step forward and two steps back. You know, it is a completely different market. Mm. It's a great opportunity. I recommend for any business to try it if you can, because, you know, it is extremely lucrative.
Yeah.
But you have to acknowledge that there are quite strong cultural differences in terms of how they approach the headhunting market versus the UK.
We have a client, Lauren Steibing, who is actually American.
Right.
But she started her recruiting career in Europe. She then launched her own search firm, did very well, but then she wanted to go back home.
Yeah.
So she's moved to New York and she got quite a shock thinking, I'm American. I've got a successful search experience.
Yeah.
And she was maintaining her clients and her team in Europe, but she was going to launch the New York office.
Yeah.
And it was so different that she was quite surprised that she really had to adapt quickly.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it is a very different market. The US market on a number of fronts is very different. It's very, very, it's very heavily networked. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more transactional than the UK.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? Because of the vastness of the country.
Okay.
Right. You don't necessarily have the luxury of being located in the same area of your clients. You know, you might be in New York, but your clients could be spread across the country. And typically that's what you see. Equally, on the other hand, what you also get is you get search firms based in one location that will just do everything in that location. So they're not specialists, they're just headhunters. But anything within that area, let's say Brooklyn, for instance, or New Jersey, they will do everything from CEOs through to toilet cleaners, right? Okay. In that area. So the variance of what headhunting was over there was very broad.
Okay.
You know, you've got the tier one search firms that are very much sort of 180. So they're either delivery or client facing. Mm-hmm. And they'll do that across country, multiple areas. Or you were localized in an area and did everything in that area. But it was very, very transactional. And I think the other cultural challenge with the US is, the UK market is one of the most mature recruitment markets in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think everyone knows that. You know, there are more recruitment businesses in the M25 than there are in the whole of Germany. You know, because of that, and because of its maturity, you know where you stand. You know, when you meet a client, you know, because of the maturity of the industry, because of their experience of dealing with recruiters, you're going to get much more transparency in terms of whether they want to work with you or not, how they want to work with you. They're more experienced.
Yeah.
The US, you know, in 1 week I was over there, I met with 40 organizations in 5 days.
People are willing to meet you there.
Willing to meet you, but, you know, and they'll tell you what you want to hear.
Okay.
But then, you know, the likelihood of that being the case is very slim.
Okay.
So, you know, that's probably one of the biggest cultural differences that we experienced in the early days.
Okay.
Is actually just wading through that rhetoric and that response to actually be able to get through to people that are being genuine in that regard.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. So you've these three milestones.
Yeah.
And you're now at what, 100 people? Or?
Yeah, that's right.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
From the description you've given, you know, albeit you said it was the tortoise versus the hare.
Yeah.
And it was one placement at a time, being clear on your vision right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Getting the right people on board, having that career development plan for them, as well as the opportunity to, you know, get share options and so on.
Yeah.
What do you think was the biggest setback or mistake or challenge along the way?
Biggest challenge was COVID.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
More so than the recession or the current slowdown.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we're fortunate that we operate in an industry that's extremely resilient. Mm. You know, regardless of whether the market is negative or positive, people need strategy people to help them navigate the path.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I knew even before the Barton partnership from my Asprey Marsden days that actually strategy was one of those areas that tends to be, you know, resilient in whatever the market conditions are. Mm. You know, in a negative market, we were busy because people needed strategy to help them understand, do we need to cut the business? Do we need to make redundancies? Mm. How do we navigate? How do we streamline ourselves? In a positive market, how do we grow? Well, we need strategy. We need strategy people.
That makes sense.
So we're in one of those unique areas that actually was impervious to whatever the market conditions were. But, you know, in terms of challenging period for us as a business, COVID definitely, as I'm sure it did for most companies, was challenging because, you know, pre-COVID, we were 100% office-based, 100% desktop computer-based.
Yeah.
You know, no one, I mean, I had a laptop, but I didn't use it. We were in the office 5 days a week on a computer.
Yeah.
You know, COVID hits, bang, we've got to go virtual. And, you know, it's one of the most challenging, but also one of the most I'm proud of is how we were able to pivot within the space of a couple of days from 100% desk bound to 100% virtual with no impact to productivity.
Zero impact?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
We really like pulled it out of the bag, you know, and you know, I don't want to experience it again.
No.
But, but you know, we really managed to, you know, completely move. And look, you know, we had a great IT support company that really stepped up. You know, it was all hands on deck with everyone in the team really sort of coming together. You know, I won't take credit for it in its entirety at all. But, you know, we managed to go from, as I say, 5 days a week desktop computer to, you know, 100% virtual. You know, we bought 70, 80 laptops, got them configured, got them aligned, defined our engagement strategy for people at home, you know, provided that level of support for those that are in a one bedroom sort of studio apartment or whatever, you know, made sure that we had engagement, that people were engaged with, that if they were struggling mentally or whatever, that we were there to support them. I remember our Christmas bash, it was virtual. You know, we spared no expense and did a whole virtual Christmas bash. We sent out care packages to everyone at their homes and then everyone dialed in for a Christmas bash. So, you know, that's probably one of the most challenging but rewarding sort of, you know, if I can say that, experiences. Look, in terms of mistakes made, I've never done anything I've regretted.
Okay.
From a business perspective. I mean, look, we've made hires that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Everyone has.
Definitely.
We've made decisions that haven't quite succeeded. That's part of growing up. You know, Richard Branson, without doubt, is probably one of my strongest business idols. You know, if you look at what he's achieved, and actually if you read and look into, you know, not his successes, but his failures, because he talks about that.
Yeah.
He's had more failures than his successes.
Yeah.
But those failures have led to better successes.
Yeah.
Look, we launched in Paris.
Okay.
We built a team in Paris. We launched in France.
It's a tough... Shouldn't
have done that. Shouldn't have done that. Yeah. I mean, you know, great people, you know, lovely people that we hired, but, you know, my God, that was really tough. And hindsight's a wonderful thing, but the reality is we shouldn't have done that. We tried the public sector. You know, we invested heavily to get onto the public sector. That was the one sector we weren't delivering against.
Yeah.
And we worked tirelessly to get on the frameworks for the public sector, and we were successful. So we thought, fantastic. Built a team, got some great people on board. We're on the frameworks. And then Labour came in, right? And, you know, sure enough, everything stops. And so, you know, it became very clear very quickly that if you're in the public sector, it is all about who you know, not what you know.
Ah.
And so there were already some well-established, entrenched recruiters that were doing very well. And despite the value of our proposition, and we were having some great conversations with people that really loved what we were doing and could see the value of what we were doing, we just couldn't crack that egg. And so we pulled the plug on that. And that's disappointing.
Yes.
But I wouldn't class that as a mistake.
Yes.
But
I love your mindset around this, where you have these, what you could see as huge setbacks, something that you put a lot of investment, energy, time into that doesn't work out. But you're viewing it as, you know, that's just a learning, you know, that's part of the process of, you know, okay, let's try something else.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, listen, we get things wrong, but, you know.
As long as it doesn't. Ruin you. Like, that's
but,
the.
But we've tried things with the best of intent.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I think that's always been sort of the fallback on it, which is that we've tried it with the best of intent.
Yeah.
We might not have succeeded, But the logic at the time was sound.
Okay.
We had people around us to help validate the argument. So it wasn't just me saying, right, I want to do this.
Yes.
Let's do it. It would be me, I want to do this. What do we all think?
Yeah.
And collectively, we would, you know, agree, support, drive, and we would try. And look, you know, I'm not a he who dares type individual, but I am about moving forward.
Yeah.
And to move forward, you've got to, you know, you've got to take chances. You've got to roll the dice.
Yeah.
And, you know, over the years, you know, we've rolled the dice and been successful. And over the years, we've rolled the dice and we haven't been successful. You know, bringing Nick on board and giving him 25% of the business was a massive roll of the dice.
Yeah.
Massive. Probably the biggest, actually, that I've done. But that massively paid off. You know, and we subsequently bought his share back. So that we bought that back into the business. He's now an NED of the company. He still retains a couple of equity points in the business. But that was a massive roll of the dice. You know, the US was a massive roll of the dice.
Yeah.
And we got that right. But we didn't with Paris. We didn't with public sector.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but we've learned from them.
Yeah. Fantastic. We could keep talking for an hour because there's things I wanted to ask you we haven't had time for. So we'll say this is for part two.
Fine.
Is how you're leveraging AI, because I know that's something you guys are really at the forefront of. But Nicholas, this has been really, really awesome. So one of the recurring themes through your story has been that you've really looked for advisors, consultants, mentors at every stage of your journey. And I know that's something that you do now as well, is as an investor and as an advisor to other companies.
Yeah.
So for an entrepreneur who, they are like you, they want to scale and they know absolutely what they want to achieve.
Yeah.
What's the most important thing that they need to focus on, you know, to really make sure that they have the best possible chance of pulling that off?
I think that it there's really two things. Firstly, what's your vision?
Yeah.
You know, what do you see as the art of the possible? What are you what do you think you can achieve? And what's going to distinguish you from the market?
Okay.
You know, the reality is it's impossible to reinvent the wheel when it comes to the recruitment industry. You know, it is what it is. It's about delivery of candidates to clients. It's about servicing and supporting a client's needs.
Yeah.
So you're not going to create something that's going to reinvent that proposition.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that's going to distinguish your value proposition to anyone else who's in the market? And for me, what's critical is identifying that niche, that specialism, that point of distinction.
Yeah.
And then it's about, well, then how are you going to take that out to market and how are you going to engage the market and what's going to be the principal core, you know, the point around that? You know, in my latest article in the Recruiter magazine, and this really sits at the heart of our success, I talk about the importance of great customer service.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that is the principal driver of our success and has to be for any business. You know, putting customers first and really sort of embedding great customer service into the ethos of the business has been a critical success factor. So if you have a vision and you've got a niche that distinguishes you in the market, and you put great customer service at the heart of that, you've got the key ingredients for success, I think. And that's why I backed George to launch SearchChain.
Yeah.
Because that's what he showed me that he possessed. And I can see that. And I thought, right, listen, let's give it a go.
Fantastic. The other thing we didn't talk about is B Corp, and that's a big, because you guys have generated £100,000 for charities.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a whole nother conversation, which we'll say to be continued. Do you know Leo Hewitt at all? Do you know that name?
No.
So Leo has been on this podcast.
Right.
He's a great young entrepreneur. He's based in Bristol.
Right.
His company is called Core 3. And he was at the Recruiter Magazine Awards last night. I think he won best, you know, newcomer, new business or something like that. But he's achieved B Corp. Like from day one, that was his goal.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting area we can dive into again.
Sure.
Next time. I've really enjoyed this.
So am I. Thank you very much for having me on board. It's been great to have a chat.
Thanks, Nicholas.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business.
And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.